Livestock Radio on the go, wherever you get your podcasts. And find us online at rootstockradio.com. Rootstock Radio is brought to you by Organic Valley.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up next at 11:30, it's an interview with the co-directors of the Vanport Music Festival. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
My name is Suzanne LeGrand, and today on our show, we are featuring the Vanport Mosaic Festival. Now in its fourth year, the Vanport Mosaic Festival is 2 weeks of memory activism, opportunities to explore and confront our local past and recent history of othering and its tragic consequences. Through exhibits, documentary screenings, tours, theater, and dialogues, the festival celebrates the lessons of resistance and resilience as defined and told by historically oppressed communities. Here is Laura Loforti, co-director of the Vanport Mosaic Festival, talking about this year's festival.
The Vanport Mosaic is a platform for memory activism. We started in 2014, and this is our fourth festival. And our passion is to amplify, present, preserve, and honor the many silenced histories around us as well. And our commitment this year is really to offer 2 weeks of memory activism. And to honor the Vanport story, which is a very important chapter of our past, but also to use that as an entry point to the many other silenced histories of our city.
I always tell people Vanport, the history of Vanport, I think the impact that Vanport had, the shipyard had, on this state, on this city, is as notable as the wagon trains coming across the West. Mm-hmm. I mean, it truly, truly changed, Vanport changed Portland forever.
This year's festival features the artwork of Hank Pander, a painter who documents the lives of people in Vanport.
My name is Hank Pander. I'm a painter. I grew up in the Netherlands during the Second World War. I was born before the Second World War, and I remember the Second World War as a child, especially the last part of it, which was an extremely grim period. I became aware of the fact that Liberty ships were built here, that were built, you know, both in Portland and in Vancouver. And it was just an enormous project, and I built like hundreds of these ships, and they were essential, and as it turned out, because the Germans were, you know, sinking all the freighters. And so there was this slogan from, we can build them faster than Hitler can sink them. Well, Hitler was sinking us, you know, people were dying, people were, you know, like huge parts of the Dutch population were murdered by the Nazis because they were Jewish. It was an enormous resistance. There were like, there was a massive starvation and stuff. It was just very, very urgent. There was then, I became aware of the city of Vanport. Vanport and Vancouver were all the people who built these ships, like in three shifts, they worked their butts off building these things. They lived there, and they were surrounded by dikes and rising water. I grew up in a country which was surrounded by dikes and rising water, and when I was like maybe 15 or so, all the dikes, a great deal of the dikes in the Netherlands broke. There was an enormous flood. Hundreds of people died. It was just an incredible national disaster. But I started reading about it, and then as it sort of drifted into the consequences of these shipyards was this event which happened here in, in Vanport. And so I started making drawings, I started doing some research on it and collect photographs and material on it, and I started making a series of pen and ink drawings. sort of in conjunction with these ship drawings, I started making drawings of Vanport and the refugees there and the dice breaking and also, you know, being forced out of your place to live and being a refugee and being discriminated against it. And it was all of a sudden these elements, other elements of American society. And it was also at a time when there were all these refugees in Syria coming through Greece and all, you know, there's this sort of, it also became suddenly a very contemporary story. But then I started, you know, looking at this material in this drowned city with these houses drifting around and people just with their clothes on their back and the children on their arm just fleeing this thing. And I thought it was so also about the times, not only then, but also now, you know, the rising water and the change in the world, the being displaced people. And I just had this incredibly powerful emotional thing. And it all ended up happening in Portland. But for me, in this project, I started just working with the community and actually working with people who actually suffered through these kind of situations themselves and stuff. It develops a language where there's a kind of sense of recognition and like a kind of also kind of like, oftentimes life is meaningless and pointless and random and violent and disturbing. But to take these kind of things which emotionally affect a person and say, okay, this is meaningless, but I can't get it out of my head. They're making a painting out of it and making it turn it into, you know, what may or may not be art, but sort of lifting it up and giving it grace is giving meaning to what is meaningless. And that is, you know, that's sort of what I like to do.
Here is Damaris Webb, co-director of the Vanport Mosaic Festival.
Art is the way that I know how to interact with the world. And I feel it is my duty as an artist to present, to make the query, to propose questions in a way people can chew on them and interact with them, receive them. Because it's important to remember, it's important to hear the stories, it's important to witness. The process of it is all part of the work, but then there's also the actual civic engagement, the actual policy change, the sphere of influencers that was spoken about earlier today.
One of the events this year is a tour conducted by the Fair Housing Council of Oregon.
The Fair Housing Council of Oregon have been doing this tour for 11 years, and I had a great joy, if I can use that word, to participate to one of these tours. And I thought this was just, it should be mandatory, really. It is a journey into the through the hidden history of discrimination of the city. And so we spend a few hours together on a bus tour, really looking at the very limited signs of what happened. And so the narrators and the people from the impacted communities, as well as Alan Lasso, who is the director of the Fair Housing Council, and many other wonderful narrators, help us to see what's not visible. It's the invisible history of what happened and how we got where we are today. So there is a rise of violence and hate crimes, but what we learn is that this is just a continuation of a history that it is since the beginning of the state of Oregon. And so it is very important to connect the dots.
At a luncheon at Ceremon House after the tour, participants on the tour talked about what they saw and what it meant to them.
I just want to thank the team that put this together.
Yes.
And I want to encourage the Housing Authority to continue and maybe double the tours. This is so rich.
Yes.
That everybody in Portland needs to hear it.
Exactly.
So I just have to say that. And Mariah,
we go
it's
way
great
back
to see you. Yeah, we go way back, and we've touched just about every stone that you covered today.
Yes.
The one thing I want us to all keep in mind, though, is no matter how hard it is, how rough it is, how you might feel like, I just really am tired of this, find the good part of it. Mm-hmm. Keep that in mind. there is a possibility for change. What do
yes,
you
it is.
Need to do to bring about the change?
I'm Janice Okamoto, and this bus tour really moved me, touched my heart, especially when we went to the Expo Center. Marlene was talking about how we, the Japanese families, had to go to the Expo Center. My family had a cleaning business in Japantown, and of course, my mother was a seamstress. I guess my dad must have been the presser, but they had a cleaning business, and of course, they had a notice that they had to leave the business and go to the Expo Center, and like Marlene said, it was hastily put together. There's barbed wires, there's a guard with a gun pointing, or a rifle pointing at you, and living in a stall with blank, not blanks, but planks over the manure and the cow urine, and my mom, you know, got sick all the time, you know, smelling it, or and it was a warm, like 103 degrees, that it would all seep through. But living like that, you know, we were like, I mean, how could they house humans in a place like that? But that's what they did. We were there till 1942, until Minidoka was open, and we, as far as I remember, we got on a bus like today, went to the Union Station, got on the bus, we had a number, each of us had a tag, got on the bus, the bus had all the shades were down, we couldn't see where we were going. For days, nobody knew where we were going. And of course I was small and, you know, probably wiggled around and, you know, wanted to play with the, you know, the shade or something. But anyway, if we finally got our, got to Minidoka, and the same thing, it was desolate place, barbed wire, guards, a guard tower, and then our place was block 34, and block 34, each block had a laundry facility, a laboratory facility, and what you call the lunch, mess hall for food, where you eat. And it broke the family, because after a while, the teenagers' kids would eat with the kids that their friends, and not eat with the family. So it kind of broke down the family. But I don't want to say anything bad about it, because when you're kids, you just play and with other kids and marbles or jump rope, and you know. But we didn't suffer. I don't think I suffered, because my parents never told my brother or me or anything about camp. It was a part of their history that was a closed book. We did not know anything how they suffered until when they started to do the redress, and finally they kind of opened up and told about their experiences. Now Densho now has people, Nisei, I don't think there's any more Iseis living, but some of the Niseis are still living, but they're in their 90s that are living, that maybe could tell what they went through. But I know my mom, when we started to go on these trips to Minidoka, my mom would not go. She says, I don't want to remember that part of my life. So she did not go. My brother and I, my sister and my son, all went to Minidoka on a pilgrimage. And I went three times to the pilgrimage. And each time we went, you know, little things like the footlocker still there. But when I went to the last time, they did the honor roll, which had all the 442nd, the 100th battalion with their names on the plaque on the honor roll. And you could just see part of the gardens. The Japanese are resilient people. They built gardens. They sent things from Rose, Sears and Roebuck's, Montgomery Ward's, and they made curtains. I don't know where they got the sewing machine, but maybe they ordered it from Sears and Roebuck's or something. They made it best as they could, but they also had my dad and my uncle to make it for the young people to enjoy part of their weekends. The mess hall was all the tables and everything was turned and piled up, and they made it. My dad had a band called the Norikua Band, and they played music of the famous one, of course, is "Don't Fist Me In," but they played. but they had a band, and the young people could dance and enjoy themselves. The boys had a basketball team. The girls did Bono Dori dancing. We learned how to dance. Well, I was still too young, but they taught dancing, ikebana, which is flower arrangement. They did learned how to do sumi painting, which is a beautiful painting with black charcoal. So they did do things to teach young people part of the culture of the Japanese. They did not teach Japanese. We never taught, because my folks and nobody taught us Japanese. They says, no, we got to be Americans, so we can't teach you Japanese. So nobody spoke Japanese. So my brother and I, we can speak a little of Japanese because of our grandparents. They still kept speaking Japanese-American, talking, but camp life, in 1945, after the war was over, our family got, I think, $25 and a bus ticket back to Portland. That's where we went to. And then how we get to Bamboo Mosaic, our family, like 300 other families, had no place to live. We couldn't afford Portland because they didn't want, we were discriminated. So we ended up staying at Vanport, and a lot of us went to Vanport because there was housing available and they accepted us. Mm-hmm. And our place was on Cottonwood Heights, so we were near the movie theater. But anyway, what I was gonna say is we played with everybody. I didn't feel any discrimination. I know that the Japanese, the Mexicans, We were with the black section. We did not live up here where the white people were. But we were discriminated in where our barracks was gonna be. But like I said, we played with everybody, and Vanport was a sad thing again because my folks lost everything again. And we did have I remembered my dad picking up friends, in our car. We were like sardines in the car trying to go up Denver Avenue, and we could see the water coming. And but like they said, you'll be well warned about the dike.
This year we feel particularly strong in exploring the past and present history of othering. How do we talk about communities? How did we do it in the past, and how do we marginalize them and talk about others in a way that allow us to do terrible things to them? And so this year festival is really an exploration from Vanport to the Max attack. We're gonna remember the second, it's the second anniversary of this tragedy, and we're gonna talk about the 30th anniversary of the murder of Mulugeta Serraw, and many other stories in between, to show that history is not in the past, history is now, it's a continuum. So our invitation to everyone is to gather around these stories. They're uncomfortable, but they're also the way we present them through theater, exhibits, screenings, dialogues. It is an opportunity to gather in a way that we usually don't allow, or we don't seek, and to be together and make meaning of all these stories and commit to do something different, because obviously this is not a good story to tell. also through these stories, we do celebrate the community resiliency. So that's a way for us to honor also the strength of the communities who are othered.
Co-director of the Vanport Mosaic Festival, Damaris Webb, is also a theater artist. This year, she presents a work in progress called Sold Out, The Economics of Our Black Body.
Civil War, the value of American slaves was worth 12 times that of just the cotton crop that year, right? Just the value of the slaves, right? So the value of what those bodies did for no recompense built this nation, were the backbone that allowed this country to make the wealth that it did. I mean, you just can't get around that. I mean, just today on this tour, to consider the fact that one of the ways that, the main way that we raise ourselves up in this country is by land ownership. And to have had this land built by people who were then given no recompense, and then were not given a level playing field over and over and over again in so many systemic ways, and to still then turn around and be like, well, come on, get it together. You know, for us to not address these stories and what's at the root of them, we just keep repeating, you know, in different ways.
This Thursday at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, there will be a screening of Transforming Hate, Mulugetau Serau's Legacy. The documentary looks at the legacy of Mulugetau Serau, an Ethiopian immigrant who was beaten to death by three white supremacists 30 years ago in Portland, Oregon. I talked to one of the co-producers of the documentary, Inutu Tsegau.
So for the Mulugetau Serau commemoration project, I first got involved in his 30th anniversary through my work at the Urban League of Portland. We were part of the Portland United Against Hate coalition, and someone at that table mentioned the name of Mulugetau Serau and the fact that 2018 marks the 30th year since he was murdered. So that's how I first heard about it, and then, you know, as part of that coalition, and also as an Ethiopian, you know, I kind of felt the need to step up and, you know, be a part of that work. So through the Urban League, I took the initiative to organize a commemoration project for him. So the commemoration project included a half day. Conference and then a project to put in physical markers. These are street sign caps, which we saw earlier on in the vicinity of Southeast 31st in Pine, where the tragedy happened. And you know, it kind of goes beyond that. There was a city proclamation that passed, naming November 13th as Mulugetau Serau Day. There was a congressional statement our congressional delegation from Oregon helped us kind of pass that as well. So that's how I heard about the story, and through a coalition that we formed, we were able to kind of pull this project together. And I think we were able to raise the awareness of people about, you know, the case and the fact that, you know, 30 years ago, there was this entirely unjustifiable hate crime that happened to a young man who was aspiring to achieve the American dream. And then back in 2016-17, you know, we still have tragedies and hate violence taking place. So it was the platform was really about like kind of connecting, checking, and seeing where we are compared to where we were in 1988, and some of where we are today is, you know, unfortunately, you know, there's so much progress and that has been made, and there's still a long way to go.
Co-director Damaris Webb talks about the importance of stories, not only stories told about, but stories told with the community.
What we aim to do with Vanport Mosaic is to tell the stories with, that the community members or the community that we're being involved in is part of the entire process all the way to the end, and that we don't abandon them afterwards, that we're still part of the community, because that's how we truly build our strengths. It's you know, as Mariah said before, you know, we're all family. We're all in this together.
The Vanport Mosaic Festival runs from May 21st to June 5th, 2019 in Portland. For more about the festival or to participate, go to www.vanportmosaic.org. I am Suzanne LeGrand for KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
Cool art, live music, cider, wine, and snacks. Heck yeah.
Come out to KBOO's first ever First Friday Art Walk event on June 7th from 6 to 9 p.m. The First Friday Art Walk is in Portland's vibrant East Side Arts District and is the gateway into Portland's thriving arts culture, including more than 23 independent galleries.
Start your night off at the KBOO Studios next First Friday, June 7th. KBOO is featuring the work of two brilliant artists, Justin Auld and Amy Kutab. There will be live music, snacks, wine available thanks to Hip Chicks Do Wine, and cider courtesy of Cider Riot.
You will also get a chance to tour our studios. Check out kboo.fm for more info. That's Friday, June 7th from 6 to 9 p.m. See you there.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Co-Housing, creating community one neighborhood at a time, on Friday, May 31st at the Elliott Center in Portland. Co-Housing, creating community one neighborhood at a time, is a public talk by Grace Kim about the loneliness epidemic in Portland and how co-housing can help. Grace is a principal at Skamata Workshop and a co-founder of Capitol Hill Urban Co-Housing in Seattle. The talk is part of the National Co-Housing Conference taking place in Portland, May 30th through June 2nd. Again, that's Co-Housing, creating community one neighborhood at a time, on Friday, May 31st at the Elliott Center, 1226 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
In local news, according to an audit released today, Portland's street repair program, Fixing Our Streets, has failed to deliver on dozens of promised transportation projects. These projects were funded by a 10-cent gas tax approved in May 2016. The program, which has generated $43 million so far, is behind schedule and lacking accountability and oversight. The city promised to use the money for more accessible crosswalks, repaved roads, and sidewalk additions. Transportation Commissioner Chloe Udaly promised that 20 of the 59 original projects would be completed in 2019. In national news, Special Counsel Robert Mueller today said that his investigation did not clear Donald Trump of wrongdoing. This is his first public statement in 2 years since his appointment to investigate Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election and links between the Trump campaign and Russia. Mueller stated that charging Trump with a crime was not an option within the guidelines of his investigation. The investigation was bound by Department of Justice guidelines that a sitting president cannot be indicted of a crime. But he made clear that his investigation did not exonerate Trump, simply that they were not allowed to charge him. 2020 Democratic presidential hopefels, including Senators Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris, reiterated their calls for Congress to act, calling Mueller's report a, quote, impeachment referral. John Bolton again ramped up his rhetoric against Iran, accusing Iran of sabotaging oil tankers off the coast of the United Arab Emirates. Iranian officials called Bolton's accusations laughable, while the country's deputy foreign minister said that Iran is still willing to start a dialogue with the U.S., but is still prepared for war if invaded. Workers for Postmates Food Delivery Service are protesting a 30% pay cut. They've launched a petition against the company in protest. This follows other recent campaigns to organize workers in the so-called gig economy. This includes workers for Uber and Instacart who are unhappy with their pay and working conditions. Tune in tonight to the KBOO News at 5 for a full investigative report on the petition against Postmates and the organizing that's being done in support of contract workers employed by the gig economy. In Arizona, the trial has begun for a geography professor charged with harboring two undocumented migrants. Professor Scott Warren was arrested in a raid in January 2018 by U.S. Border Patrol agents who were after two migrants hiding in the shower of a ramshackle building used by humanitarian groups. The case could set a precedent about what assistance U.S. citizens are allowed to give to undocumented migrants. The Supreme Court has declined to hear a challenge to a Pennsylvania district's inclusive bathroom policy. LGBTQ activists are calling the ruling an enormous victory for transgender students. The ruling affirms that school districts around the country have the right to implement inclusive bathroom policies to provide facilities appropriate to people of all genders. An unknown person set himself on fire outside the White House yesterday afternoon. It is not clear at this time if this was an act of protest. The fire was put out by emergency personnel, and the man was taken to the hospital. During the Vietnam War, self-immolation was used as a form of protest against the war and violence, with Buddhist nuns and monks in Vietnam setting themselves on fire and sitting in a meditative poses until death. In international news, international stock markets fell 2.5-month low on Wednesday amidst fears of an escalating trade war between the United States and China, with economic data showing that U.S. manufacturing growth dropped to 10-year lows. Another round of tariffs would sharply raise the risk of a U.S. recession, according to an analysis by Reuters. And Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law and chief Mideast advisor,